would be a terrible travesty to have to reduce those efforts that you and we have made to reach out to rural Alaska and rural Alaskans.
The state's Chief Justice tells lawmakers to remember rural Alaska when they cut this court's budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young objects to a proposal to privatize part of the FAA.
And if they're going to run this FAA, I don't think the consumer is going to get the right representation on that board.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven, Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. And by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN.
Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Craig Stowers says the court system has taken steps to cut costs. In the annual State of the Judiciary address to a joint session of the legislature today, he said the courts plan on more cuts. But Stowers also gave legislators some advice as they shape the budget. He said if leaders act in the interest of Alaskans, their constituents will support them.
My friends, do not be afraid. Fear is the mind killer. Be bold. Also, be selfless and look to the greater good. You are our elected leaders, and leaders sometimes have to make hard decisions their constituents don't immediately understand or agree with.
Stowers also urged legislators to ensure that the state's budget problems don't fall too heavily on any one group. The court system cut its budget by 3.5% this year, equal to $3.8 million. Stowers says if the legislature further cuts the court's budget, some court locations may have to close. He says this would hit rural Alaska the hardest, where the courts serve as the face of state government.
It would be a terrible travesty to have to reduce those efforts that you and we have made to reach out to rural Alaska and rural Alaskans, you know, including our Native brothers and sisters out there.
Governor Bill Walker proposed a total cut of $100 million to the state budget, and legislators have been seeking deeper cuts. The Senate's already large majority grew even bigger today. Senator Donnie Olson joined the majority caucus. The move by the Golovin Democrat means that 16 of the 20 senators are in the majority. Olson says he's honored to join the majority and will lend a strong voice for rural Alaskans. He joined Senator Lyman Hoffman of Bethel as another Democrat in the Republican-led majority. Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat, says her caucus members were disappointed, but she says they're pleased the majority will benefit from a member with progressive values who supports public education and Medicaid expansion. As presidential primary season plays out across the country, you may be wondering when Alaskans have their say. The answer is next month. But Republicans and Democrats in the state use different procedures for choosing delegates. The Democrats will gather in groups, like in the recent Iowa caucus. For Republicans, it's a more traditional ballot. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman has more.
Alaska's major parties will pick their candidates on different days. The Republicans will choose theirs on March 1st, also known as Super Tuesday. Their election, known as a presidential preference poll, will be conducted much like other elections. Each voter will be given a piece of paper with the candidates' names. They'll mark their preferred candidate and place the paper in a ballot box. Alaska will have the same number of delegates as much larger states like Oregon. That's because Alaska has voted heavily Republican in previous federal and state elections. Party Chairman Peter Goldberg said the combination of voting early and being heavily Republican gives the party outsized sway.
Even though by population we are a tiny state, we have a disproportionately large influence upon the ultimate selection.
Alaska Democrats will hold their caucuses across the state on March 26th, the same day as Hawaii and Washington. In the caucuses, voters who support each candidate will gather in a corner of their local polling place before casting ballots. Alaska Democratic Party Executive Director Kay Brown says the party has been energized by having a competitive nominating process between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
I think that it makes it more interesting to people, the fact that there's a contest, and it certainly will generate interest by the campaigns and turning their people out to take part in the caucuses.
For Republicans, a large field of candidates has drawn interest. Goldberg says Republicans also are capitalizing on a competitive primary season by increasing their registration.
People in Alaska, the Republicans in Alaska, are very excited, and I'm finding just on the phone calls that come to me that people are switching to the Republican Party. It's at least once a day that some Democrat is calling me and saying, how do I switch?
But while there is early excitement about the election in the state, few national campaigns have invested resources to build up campaign organizations in Alaska. On the Republican side, Ben Carson and Marco Rubio have state campaign coordinators. Sanders also has a coordinator based at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Matt Dean, a Republican activist, says the state will always struggle to receive large investments from presidential campaigns.
It does take a little bit of a time to get your base spread out to every state. Alaska only has 3 electoral votes. So, I mean, I do understand from a strategic standpoint. I did used to work on campaigns, but it is very nice to see when people at least make the effort to get up here.
The Republican preference poll and Democratic caucus will divide the state's delegates proportionally. But the elections don't actually determine who will travel to each party's national convention. The delegates will be chosen in local conventions, which also begin in March. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A U.S. House committee is considering a bill that would make the nation's air traffic controllers employees of a nonprofit corporation and shift financial responsibility for safe air travel away from taxpayers. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaska Congressman Don Young argued against it this morning, but the Air Traffic Controllers Union supports the bill.
The prime supporter of the FAA remodel is Representative Bill Schuster, a Pennsylvania Republican who has the job Congressman Young used to have, chairman of House Transportation. In a video announcing the bill, Schuster says the FAA has spent billions trying to modernize, but can't keep pace with growth in air travel.
And unless we head in a bold new direction, the system will become crippled with delays. American manufacturing jobs could move overseas, and our country could lose its lead in aviation. That's why we need the Aviation Innovation Reform and Reauthorization Act, the AIR Act.
The bill would create a new air traffic control corporation, while the FAA would remain the safety regulator. Schuster says the government won't be responsible for any debt the corporation takes on. Young says the bill would solve some problems with the FAA, but he objects on several counts. For one, the Alaska congressman says the airline industry would be overrepresented on the board of the Air Traffic Control Corporation. These days, Young says that amounts to giving the reins to 4 major airlines.
4. And if they're going to run this FAA, I don't think the consumer is going to get the right representation on that board.
And Young says the new system would put Congress in the back seat while giving the president power to appoint 2 board members.
Why should we let a president appoint them? This is our job as legislators. If we're going to change the system, then let's change it with us having some control over it financially, and the board members should be appointed from the Congress. I'm not going to give any president any more authority. That's the wrong with this Congress. We've done this over and over again. We give the president, we might as well have a king.
Also, Young says the bill would undermine essential air service by taking away its dedicated funding. The program subsidizes air travel to dozens of Alaska airports, and Young says it's crucial to the state.
That's what serves my community. I don't have highways. I don't have streets. I've got air.
In Alaska, the proposal has alarmed aviation interests, including the Alaska Airmen Association, which represents general aviation. The bill would exempt non-commercial pilots from new user fees. But Adam White, who works on government affairs issues for the Alaska Airmen, says he doubts the exemption would hold. Eventually, White says small plane pilots could be subject to fees for contacting air traffic control.
Our concern is that's a huge safety issue because a lot of folks simply won't avail themselves to the services that would be there and could be making decisions of flying in bad weather without the help of ATC.
White also questions the new model as he reads it in the bill.
Handing over all the FAA's assets with the navigation aids, the radio communication outlets, all those things handed over to a private corporation that if it fails, the way it's currently written, our understanding is that the FAA would have to buy all that infrastructure back at market value.
Air traffic controllers have objected to many past calls to privatize the FAA, but union president Paul Rinaldi testified in favor of this plan. Rinaldi, head of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, says controllers have been devastated by budget uncertainty and hiring freezes. Rinaldi says the bill will help controllers get the modern equipment they need.
And most importantly, better staffing. We are crucially at this point with our staffing, where controllers are having tough times to get breaks, take time off, to make sure they have appropriate amount of, you know, fatigue mitigation going on. Our staffing, we must address the staffing of our facilities.
The bill remains in the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and is likely to be amended before it hits the floor. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, translating a summit on racial equity into gravity art.
The faces are even more obscured, so you can see they're losing like a sense of self, the more and more that the culture is stripped away from them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
There was a fatal officer-involved shooting in Barrow this morning. According to the North Slope Borough Mayor's Office, the incident happened around 4 a.m. A North Slope Borough police officer was responding to a call for assistance when the shooting took place. The mayor's office identified the victim as Vincent Nagyak III. Nagyak was the nephew of State Representative Ben Nagyak, a Democrat from Barrow. Vincent Nagyak was 36 years old and a lifelong resident of Barrow. Along with serving as fire chief, he worked for the Department of Corrections in Barrow for more than 10 years. In a statement, Representative Ben Nagyak says the family still doesn't know all the facts. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation arrived on the scene in Barrow this afternoon. The officer involved in the shooting was not injured, but his name will not be released for 72 hours as per the department policy. Sitka has settled out of court with a high school student who was tasered in the city's jail in 2014. Franklin Hugendorn will be paid $350,000 by Sitka's insurance carrier. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Hugendorn was 18 years old and attending Mount Edgecombe High School when he was arrested in September of 2014 outside a Sitka bar where he had been attempting to buy a drink. Police took Hugendorn into custody. A video of the arrest, which went viral on social media last fall, shows Hugendorn being forcibly restrained by a jailer and two police officers and repeatedly tasered as his clothes are removed. The settlement was negotiated between the Alaska National Insurance Company on behalf of the city of Sitka and the two legal firms representing Hugendorn. Sitka's municipal attorney, Robin Kochek, says it was a standard no-fault, no-admission settlement. She's satisfied with the outcome.
It's not a windfall for anybody. We felt that it was very fair.
Hugendorn never filed a lawsuit over the incident. His attorneys instead submitted a draft complaint, which contained only the threat of a lawsuit. As a result, Kochak says the settlement agreement does not bind Sitka, for example, to change police procedures or any other action that might be compelled by a judge had the matter gone to court. Franklin Hugendorn is now 20 years old. His attorneys could not be reached for comment by press time. The conduct of the officers in the incident remains under investigation by the FBI. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
It's been almost 5 months since three Kodiak police officers pinned an autistic man to the ground and pepper sprayed him at point-blank range. Nick Pletnikoff was not charged with any crime after the incident, but the Kodiak Police Department hired a police consultant from Soldotna to investigate the actions of its officers. The report, released last week, found the officers acted appropriately. Others disagree, including the Pletnikoff family, who yesterday filed suit in Kodiak Superior Court against the city, the police department, and two of the three officers involved. When contacted Tuesday, the family's attorney said the reason the third officer was not named would eventually be explained. The 15-page complaint claims Nick Pletnikoff's special needs condition should have been obvious to any reasonable officer at the scene. The Pletnikoffs are asking for a judgment in excess of $100,000, as well as punitive damages, and are asking for a jury trial to be held in Kodiak. Former Wrangell doctor Greg Szilard was sentenced Tuesday to 20 years in prison for receipt and distribution of child pornography. Szilard, 54 years old, will also have a lifetime of supervised release after prison and a $25,000 fine. He was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Juneau. A jury found Szilard guilty last summer after a forensic examination of his laptop revealed evidence of hundreds of child pornography files. At the sentencing hearing, Chief U.S. District Judge Timothy Burgess focused on the sophisticated way Szilard obtained and hid the illegal material. Szilard was employed as a family doctor by Alaska Island Community Services and served under a contract with Wrangell Medical Center. If you feel like you've been hearing about new marijuana rules a lot lately, you're right. With the state and local governments fast approaching the start of the application process on February 24th, communities and potential cannabis businesses need to be on the same page about all kinds of nitty-gritty rules, everything from how much an application costs to how far a marijuana shop can be from a school. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, Anchorage ironed out many of these details last night, and nobody left completely happy.
The Xerox machine chugged along late into the night as lawmakers discussed 20 different measures on cannabis, many of them hot off the press. The devil is in the details, and Assemblymember Bill Evans of South Anchorage says even though these are rule changes to a land use ordinance, they will shape Alaska's largest commercial cannabis market in the months and years ahead.
We have such limited land available for this industry. Every one of these restrictions makes things more expensive and makes the chances of success for a legitimate industry replacing the black market that much harder.
Businesses will have to be at least 500 feet from sensitive establishments like schools and churches, and that distance will be measured from lot line to lot line as the crow flies, rather than by pedestrian paths, which regulators say it makes their jobs a lot easier. Another decision allows police officers to be present during facility inspections, and Evans worries that altogether, the rules tend more towards limitation than liberalism.
Some people have an overabundance of caution when it comes to marijuana and are trying to restrict it as much as they can.
Industry agrees.
That would be me.
Kim Cole is with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation and is planning on applying for a business license that includes a space to consume cannabis products within the same shop where a customer buys them, i.e. on-site consumption, a bit like the brew pub model. Because the Assembly declined to pass an explicit allowance for on-site consumption, saying that it wasn't sufficiently fleshed out yet, Cole doesn't have clarity on the local rules. She says she'll keep getting the space ready with the hope that the Assembly will quickly redraft a rule, giving the okay for on-site consumption in the weeks ahead.
And if they don't, then I will just have a really big retail, or I don't know, I will have to revamp from there, I guess. That is one of the things that I was told before I got into this, is you have to be flexible, and yes, you have to be flexible.
Cole says the process was flawed too, that the Assembly did not heed recommendations made to them from the Planning and Zoning Board, citing one Assembly member in particular.
Planning and Zoning also stated publicly that they felt as though the Assembly was trying to zone us out of existence, and clearly that is Ms. Dombowski's intent.
The industry may be mad, quite frankly. I'm more concerned about my constituents being represented than them being mad at me.
Many of the items Assemblymember Amy Domboski introduced pushed for more stringent zoning measures, not across the whole municipality, but specifically in her Chugiak Eagle River District, which has its own advisory board that handles zoning codes. Domboski's argument throughout the night was that her communities have a more conservative take on commercial cannabis and that they were insufficiently consulted. The rush of amendments ahead of discussion, she says, is partly due to scrambling to incorporate feedback from her constituents after a town hall meeting over the weekend.
The fact of the matter is, this is a process, and municipal code guarantees community input. And unfortunately, at this point, they hadn't weighed in on the changes from P&Z. So it was my job, and it was Mr. Starr's job, to ensure that the community voice was heard loud and clear. And I think we achieved that tonight.
The local votes come just ahead of a Thursday meeting by the state's Marijuana Control Board in Juneau to discuss regulations and an updated timeline for issuing permits. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
UConn Quest defending champion Brent Sass was the first musher to reach the race's halfway point at Dawson City, UConn today. Sass arrived in the historic Gold Rush City at 11:21 a.m., still running the full team of 14 dogs he started the race with in Fairbanks on Saturday. Sass wins 4 ounces of gold nuggets for being first to Dawson. But the race is far from over, with former champs Alan Moore and Hugh Neff just a few hours behind. KUAC's Molly Reddick reports.
Brent Sass covered the 150-mile distance from Eagle to Dawson in 2 runs. In Eagle, he said his team was feeling better after starting the race with some stomach issues.
The whole week leading up to the race, they had stomach flu or whatever, and then it had gotten better.
But for the first 300 miles, it took a lot more effort to keep them full and hydrated.
Because you have to, like, basically hand feed them and soak things differently and go through 5 different types of snacks before they decide that they're going to eat one of them.
Hugh Neff is down to 11 dogs after dropping 3 in Eagle. They were his junior dogs, each 2 years old or younger.
2 of them, this is their first race ever, so I was pretty amazed that they made it to Slavin's and to Eagle, respectively.
Now he has a veteran team. The final few mushers came into Eagle Wednesday morning. Luke Twiddell arrived at 6 a.m. The UConn musher has run the quest before, but he's never seen jumble ice this bad.
It looks like picture of the moon kind of thing, but white. It's unbelievable.
There's a trail broken through the jumble, but mushers can still run into ice boulders on the corners or tricky sections of banked ice. Twiddell recalled a section of trail that was slanted sideways, where he could hardly keep his sled upright.
It's just clear ice, and you can see all the mark of the sled that was just go up. Bang, hitting the bottom, and then your dog's here, and you try just to keep your sled, like, and then you hit branch and trees, and at one point I heard, I look, whoa, my snowshoes was on the trail.
It was hard to stop, too. The brakes can't bite into the ice, and the drag mat used to slow down the sled gets clogged with ice.
If I dropped a few things, I just didn't stop. I just carried on. I said, oh, no, I'm not stopping here.
Luke has 2 kids who want to run the race one day.
If it's conditioned like that, I don't want them to go through that. It's too crazy.
Mushers are done with the jumble ice. After Eagle, they travel on overland trails to Dawson. On the UConn Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Molly Reddig.
Last week, the First Alaskans Institute held a summit on racial equity. Speakers focused on topics like internalized oppression, unconscious bias, and finding healthy ways to talk about race. Off to the side of the stage, a man shook cans of spray paint and turned the ideas into art. KSK's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman spoke with Ariello Bisco Taylor about his work.
Bisco's first professional art gig was in the 5th grade in Anchorage, when he matured from sketching cartoons to drawing portraits.
And from there, people would ask me if I could draw so-and-so for them, or, you know, somebody from their favorite boy band or whatever it would be. And usually I turn them down, but then people started, like, giving me money.
When he was 14, he pushed aside pictures of NSYNC and turned to graffiti art. He says it took over his world.
I didn't go like a day without either sketching something or doing graffiti somewhere or thinking about stocking up on paint or where I'd like to paint. Even as I like walk around or ride the bus to school or anything like that, and your eyes kind of like scan places where it would look good.
10 years later, he doesn't have much time for painting graffiti. He's too busy working two jobs and helping care for his toddler. But last week, he stepped away from graphic design and tattooing to sit in on the Equity Summit. As speakers told of hating their own skin and being torn from their cultures at boarding schools, he painted streaks of red and black on a canvas. In the foreground, he drew faces of Native peoples with cultural symbols surrounded by bright yellow. But as the red and black forces of assimilation took hold,
the faces are even more obscured, so you can see they're losing like a sense of self the more and more that the culture is stripped away from them. And that was just gathered from the speeches over the first day. So notes that I kind of jot down from the keynote speakers.
Bisco identifies as Black and Aleut, though he says he doesn't know much about his own Aleut history. But he says he understands internalized racism.
There were a lot of times, mainly in like elementary school, middle school, early on in high school, where a lot of kids would say like really bigoted things about Alaska Natives. And me being Black passing would not realize that I was in fact half Aleut.
He says it used to make him feel ashamed until he started working with First Alaskans Institute. He began talking about issues of race and learning about his identity, some of the solutions that surfaced during the second day of the summit. Those suggestions worked their way into his next painting, a scarred tree whose roots grow from the images of the first painting and result in leaves drawn using words of hope.
Through the adversity, we still keep our strong roots, and the top of the tree, which would represent the future. And I wrote a lot of the keywords in there. They're really obscured, but I find that having them not so legible kind of adds to it. You have to strain your eyes a little bit to really look in there.
Bisco says the art contains symbolism that asks people to think about the challenging topic of race, even if they aren't ready for an outright conversation. His paintings will be displayed at the First Alaskans Institute in Anchorage. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Russell and Laura Craigle in Nome, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Katarina Sestaric in Wrangell, Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Molly Reddick on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.